Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to Premier Incorporated Implementing a Pharmacy Waste Management System conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, November the 8th, 2007. And it is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Andrea Marlowe. Please proceed, ma'am.
Thank you, Mirella. On behalf of Premier here in Charlotte, North Carolina, we'd like to welcome you to our program this afternoon on implementing a pharmaceutical waste management system. To begin, I'd like to actually just start with a few housekeeping frequently asked questions. For your information, the presentation is being recorded, as you just heard, and will be archived on Premier's website following the session. We will have a question and answer session after Charlotte Smith's presentation, and we encourage you to either hold your questions until then or feel free to include them in the Q&A panel that you see below. If you do not see that panel, you can go up to the top nav bar under the View menu and then click Panels and you'll see the Q&A one. If you have any difficulties with the link that was provided, you may also download the slides from Premier's website. Simply go to premierinc.com, www.premierinc.com, and then click the education/newsletters link under the heading that says Reducing Costs. If you have any audio difficulties during this, you may dial star followed by 0 to access an operator who will be able to help you. Now, on our call, I'd like to introduce Fred Payne, Premier Senior Director of Pharmacy Affairs, and Charlotte Smith, our speaker, who is the President of Pharmacology Associates, which he founded in 2000 to assist the healthcare industry in reducing and managing pharmaceutical waste. She's a member of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, and the American Society for Healthcare Environmental Services. Pharmacology is a Premier contracted supplier, and its service agreement with Premier provides consulting services surrounding facilities processes of identification, handling, and disposal of hazardous pharmaceutical waste in an environmentally friendly manner, compliant with Joint Commission guidelines and governmental regulations. We also actually are pleased to have quite a few non-Premier visitors that were joining us through the Safety Institute, Premier Safety Institute, which provides safety resources and tools to promote a safe healthcare delivery environment for patients, workers, and communities. On that site, www.premierinc.com/safety, there's a collection of more than 50,000 pages of issue summaries, resources, tools, downloads, and links, particularly a wealth of information on this topic of pharmaceutical waste management. We invite you to go ahead and check out that website following the call. As I mentioned, www.premierinc.com/safety. Now it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Charlotte Smith to begin. Charlotte?
Thank you very much, Andrea. We're delighted to have so many people on the call. And what we'd like to do is begin by looking at our goals for this afternoon. We want to develop a better understanding of the regulatory and environmental reasons for managing pharmaceutical waste more stringently. We'll review the definitions of hazardous waste as they apply to waste pharmaceuticals, and we'll explore implementation models that have been developed throughout the country for managing hazardous pharmaceutical waste. Whoops, sorry, it'll take me just a minute to get the hang of this. A little too quick on the trigger here. I think it's important to ask who are the regulators, because this is actually an expanding group, if you will. First of all, we have the US EPA federally in Washington at headquarters and also in 10 regions throughout the country. The Office of Solid Waste, Hazardous Waste Division has been the primary regulator, if you will, that has shown an interest in this area. But we're now seeing the Office of Water starting to get involved, and we'll talk a little bit about that today. Every state except Iowa and Alaska has an authorized state hazardous waste program. So for all the other states, you have both your state that you have to be concerned about, because they do have the right to be stricter. They must be at least as stringent as EPA. And then EPA still does retain the ability to do inspections and enforcement within those states. At the local level, you have publicly owned treatment works. These are your wastewater treatment plants. And they have a requirement to meet federal effluent guidelines, and we'll see in a moment why that's important. So it's possible that you could actually have some restrictions imposed by your local sewage treatment plants in addition to the EPA and the states. And then, of course, we don't want to forget Joint Commission. As many of you use them as your accrediting body, and, of course, federal funding is dependent on that accreditation. They are becoming more assertive, shall we say, in looking at waste issues. One of the things I wanted to bring to your attention, which is relatively new, back in May of this year, there was a meeting on the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic. You might wonder why anyone from five continents would go to that particular site. Apparently, there's a 30-year study going on there regarding environmental exposure, probably because of its isolation. And what the 200 scientists have put together is a statement warning of something that they are calling fetal programming due to exposure of the fetus to toxic substances. And this is resulting in changes down to the second and third generation. They're finding that genes are actually being inappropriately turned on and off during fetal development that will impact the organism through the rest of their life, and in this case, the human being. And you can see from the list of areas, obesity, diabetes, cancer, so on and so forth, fairly significant list of degenerative and chronic conditions that are of great concern to us, especially as we get a larger population moving into later life. So they're really saying, instead of saying the dose makes the poison, which has been traditional toxicology for thousands of years, they're looking at replacing that with the timing makes the poison, and they're recommending that testing now be done because over 80% of our major chemicals have never been tested for damage to early development. So that's a pretty chilling concept. And it also reflects what was developed in 1998 as sort of a leading thought process at, I'm pleased to say, in Racine, Wisconsin. I live here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. At the Johnson Wax Foundation, a number of, again, environmental scientists and toxicologists got together to start looking at the concept of endocrine disruption, which is really what we're talking about here. And they developed something called the precautionary principle. Basically, when an activity raises threats of harm to human health or the environment, precautionary measures should be taken, even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. The idea being that we really can't possibly do enough double-blind controlled studies to understand this very complex environment. So I think this feeds back well into what was discovered in the Faroe Islands report. This leads us to probably one of the reasons, one of the drivers, along with the USGS report from a few years ago of drugs in surface and ground and drinking water, that the new effluent guidance guidelines that have just been published October 18th in the Federal Register by the Water Division of EPA are looking at major pollutants of concern, including pharmaceuticals and endocrine-disrupting compounds, because, of course, there's a number of chemicals that aren't drugs that fall into that category. Regarding unused pharmaceuticals, they're looking specifically at physicians' offices, long-term care facilities, veterinary care services, hospitals, and clinics, and they're actively soliciting data, information, and comments. Just saw a newsletter come out from Region 3 today, putting this all in an easy-to-access format that people can respond to in terms of what they feel is being added to the water system. They have a large study going on in this health service industrial sector, as they call it, under the Clean Water Act. There was a conference call about a week and a half ago, had about 150-some people on it looking at talking about this. And you can see the scope of the study is quite broad, highlighting good voluntary practices, focusing on unused or expired pharmaceutical discharges, looking at current industry practices, guidance, and regulatory requirements, and then the more technical aspects regarding the wastewater treatment plants. They have a very aggressive schedule. They hope to complete their data collection by the end of this calendar year and then actually do estimated pollutant loadings by the middle of 2008. It may be likely that they'll be sending out some fairly detailed surveys to selected organizations in long-term care and perhaps even veterinary hospitals. So I think what's important to know is that we're really going beyond the initial hazardous waste concept to looking at really the whole scope of pharmaceuticals, not just the drugs that we'll be defining today. And then, of course, under Joint Commission, under the Environment and Care Standards, we do have in hospitals the requirement to manage hazardous materials and, you might say, hazardous waste. Modify that word a little bit. And we won't spend a lot of time going deeper into these, but this is definitely where Joint Commission does come into play. I've taken a look at the proposed revisions. They really haven't explored this too much more. I'd like to see them divide hazardous materials, which is OSHA, from hazardous waste, which is EPA, because I think there's a lot of confusion around getting your OSHA hazmat employee exposure issues resolved, but still not having dealt with your EPA issues. In fact, if you take a look at the definitions of OSHA hazardous drugs, which have been delineated in the NIOSH Hazardous Drug Alert, which is now a couple of years old, and then also in the ASHP guidelines on handling hazardous drugs, we know that there are specific definitions regarding employee exposure. And what I've done in this slide is to try to pull apart how different they are from the EPA definitions. So on the left side in the red, we have our OSHA hazardous drug definitions, and you can see the common ones, genotoxicity, teratogenicity, and so forth. And, of course, these are big employee exposure risks. Chemotherapy agents are primary, endocrine disruptors like estrogens and so forth, and Pitocin fit into that. On the right side, we have our EPA definitions, which are totally different. We've got P and U listed, and we'll talk about epinephrine base as we go a little further. Big deal there, big change. We've also got characteristics, which we'll talk about. And the slice in the middle, where they overlap, is actually very, very small. We have 9 chemotherapy drugs that are P and U listed that are also hazmat. We've got 3 that are ignitable. But basically, there's very little overlap. And in the best of all worlds, we'd actually see these circles come much closer together. Because I can't help but think if it's something that's not good for employee exposure, it's probably not very good for the environment. But just so you're aware that these are two different definitions, and you need to really look at EPA from a separate perspective. Let's kind of get closer into the hospitals now and look at what we really need to deal with. This is probably one of the most interdisciplinary activities you'll ever engage in. It's a great way to break down the silos because all these departments I've listed here really have to work together. The primary would be pharmacy, nursing, environmental services, and safety. But you really need to pull in as many of these other departments as possible because it won't work with just one department being given all the responsibility. Granted, they will sort themselves out in that pharmacy will be primarily responsible for identification of the hazardous drugs, hazardous waste, I should say, whereas environmental services and safety will be primarily responsible for actual disposal. But ironically, many of the drugs get disposed up in the nursing unit. So they're a huge player, and they must be involved in this. Now I'd like to take a look at RCRA as the defining regulation, and I'm sure many of you are already familiar with this. It's a 30-year-old rule, and it was enacted because we had a lot of problems in the country with waste being disposed in the ground and leaking and causing neighborhoods to be condemned and so forth. So we needed the rule. One of the difficulties for us in healthcare is that it was really designed for heavy industry. So when they promulgated this, they did not think about vials and IVs and ampules and that sort of thing. They thought about 55-gallon drums and tanker cars and so forth. So I've always told people there are things about RCRA that don't make sense, and if you try to be totally rational, you'll only make yourself crazy. So I think our job, and we're starting to see some results from that, is to first of all understand it, comply with it as it's written, and then work towards having changes. And we'll see one of those changes today, which is pretty exciting. This rule defines hazardous waste, and it requires cradle-to-grave tracking of hazardous waste. For those of us in pharmacy, it's not that different on the uniform hazardous waste manifest from a 222 form for Schedule II drugs. Very similar in terms of the amount of control that goes into that. This rule is every bit as serious as Drug Enforcement Administration or any of the other federal and state rules we operate under. And coming out of pharmacy again, we learned so much during our education. It was hard to believe when I first got into this that there was a whole body of law that applied to pharmacy and pharmaceuticals that I had never heard of. But it does have to be taken seriously. There is both civil and criminal liability. Civilly, it would be the state and or US EPA that would do enforcement. And then if it went to criminal, that could include, as you see, the FBI, Attorney General, and grand jury. I have not heard of it ever going criminal for a hospital situation. I did hear just a couple weeks ago of a professor in Washington State who knowingly, willfully dumped hazardous waste down the drain and is now facing some jail time and a fine. So you know, being professional doesn't keep you out of potentially this type of situation. But even under the civil rules, the corporate fines can be up to $32,500 per violation per day, and that includes throwing out one thing today and throwing it out again tomorrow. So you can see how it doesn't take long, and we have seen some significant fines, some of them close to $300,000 or above, for violations in this area. Obviously, you can see it gets real personal if it does go criminal. Managers up through the CEO are liable, and I did put on here an address for a website for how EPA makes those decisions. Again, hopefully we'll have some opportunity in our industry to get up to speed before it goes in that direction. Region 2, which is New York, New Jersey, the Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico, really started the primary enforcement at EPA back in about 2003, and they put on a number of very good educational seminars, not only for their region, but they came as far west as Chicago. I had the opportunity to hear them there, and I thought this slide was a really good one. It shows where they were finding healthcare RCRA violations, and I really just want to point out to you for today's talk the right-hand red quadrant, almost a complete quadrant, identification of hazardous waste being almost a fourth of the violations. And I would bet that a lot of that came out of pharmacy and pharmaceuticals, because rather than lab, where you have a relatively finite number of chemicals you're working with, when you get into pharmacy, you can have easily between 2,000 and 4,000 items, and each one of those needs to be evaluated, which is a pretty daunting task. So we can see why that could have been a problem for people. Now we want to really look up close and personal, so to speak, at the different rules and how they apply to drugs. And we find that there is a P list of chemicals in the regulations, and if a drug is on the P list and it's the sole active ingredient and it's unused, it will be a hazardous waste. And if you dilute it, basically you just create more of it. There is one exception to that we'll talk about in a bit. If it's on the U list, likewise, sole active ingredient and unused, it will become a hazardous waste. Those two lists are actually the easy part, because most of them are listed by generic name, and we can actually find them by going through the list. Now, there's hundreds of chemicals, but you can ferret them out. Where it gets a lot tougher are the characteristics of hazardous waste, which are ignitability, toxicity, corrosivity, and reactivity. So each item that is carried and eventually perhaps discarded has to be evaluated to see if it meets one of those four characteristics. Now, our big exciting news, which I'm sure many of you have already heard about, kind of through the grapevine, regards the P list. If we take a look at what's on here, the first one, arsenic trioxide, and I put it in green because it's chemotherapy, because I want to make a point about that later, that we can understand, really nasty. What had been giving people such heartburn was epinephrine, because it was our understanding all this time, generally throughout the country, that all epinephrine was to be managed as PO42 hazardous waste. And, of course, you generate a lot of it. It's all over your hospital. You have it in the OR, in the ICUs, and so forth, your crash carts. And it was causing people, or hospitals, I should say, to become large quantity generators. Well, as of October, actually, 15th, we heard about it on the 16th. It actually was dated the 15th. EPA has decided, stimulated by the state of Colorado, I might add, that PO42 as a salt, epinephrine salts, are not listed hazardous waste. And never were. So that was pretty interesting. So epinephrine base, the actual pure epinephrine, does remain listed. At Pharmacology here, we spent a week going through our entire database and determined that none of the preparations that are used medicinally in dosage forms are the base. They're all either borates, bitartrates, or hydrochlorides. So all of them will come out of regulation. That's huge. Now, that's federally. What we've been doing now is contacting the states to find out if they will accept this view. They don't have to formally adopt it. All they have to do is agree. Not everyone's done that, and not everyone's prepared to do that. And we have a number of states that have said, we'll get back to you. So they're still thinking it over. It's a big change for them. And they want to, I guess, evaluate that and make sure they want to go in that direction. So I would encourage you in this interim period, before you get too euphoric, to check with your state and make sure that you can, in fact, either no longer manage it as hazardous, epinephrine salts as hazardous, or if you're moving into this, do not need to start. Nicotine is interesting. Mostly you're talking about the patch and the gum. And, of course, if you're wasting it after it's been used by the patient, it falls out of regulation because it's no longer unused. Nitroglycerin is interesting because under a ruling in 2001, the federal government excluded it because it was only listed for reactivity. Pure nitro is very reactive, but we have such weak solutions in all of our medicinal forms it never reacts. So it's been out of regulation federally. This was a formal adoption process at the state level, and not all states have done it, and not all states are going to do it. So nitroglycerin, you definitely have to check with your state. Phentermine is the diet drug. Probably most of you aren't carrying that. It's a controlled substance. And then we have the two physostigmines, the base and the salicylate, and warfarin over 0.3%. All of the warfarin tablets meet this criterion, so they are all P-listed ways. But I thought that was really good news for everybody. For those of you that don't routinely deal with the drugs, if you're not in pharmacy or in nursing, this is what some of these look like, and there's nothing on here that tells you that it's a P-listed hazardous waste. You really have to know that through your own research or work. If we look at the U-list, I've put about half of them on here. There's closer to 25 of them. Chlorohydrate's a controlled substance. That makes it interesting to get rid of. And then the items in green are chemotherapy drugs. And I just want to point out that these 8 drugs, along with the arsenic trioxide, are the only chemotherapy drugs that are listed by EPA. They have not kept up with drug development. These were in use back in 1976. And really, the list should have been updated. We have over 100 now that are just as toxic that federally, through RCRA, would not be considered hazardous waste. So we always want to encourage people to manage them as hazardous waste, just as a best management practice. You can see lindanes on here, saccharins on here, sweet and low from your dietary department. I can't use it anymore, having known this. So just to make that little aside. And again, looking at what these look like, nothing screams hazardous waste on here. Just look like routine drugs, so it is very difficult for pharmacy and everyone else to figure out which drugs you have to worry about. Now we want to move into ignitability as one of the characteristics. Anytime you have an aqueous or water solution that contains 24% alcohol or more by volume and a flash point of less than 140 degrees Fahrenheit, you do have a hazardous waste if you discard it. It's very difficult to get flash point data for drug formulations. So we have basically said at pharmacology, if it's got the alcohol content of 24% or more, manage it as hazardous waste, unless you really want to do the research on those flash points. You can also have a non-aqueous solution, like acetone, for example, or flexible collodion, which we use for wart remover base, that will meet the flash point and will be considered ignitable. We have a few drugs that may be considered oxidizers. We have some inhalers that have flammable propellants. So those all fit into this category. One of the interesting ones is paclitaxel coming into pharmacy. It's a chemo drug. It's about 50% alcohol. So if pharmacy disposes of that concentrated vial, they have a hazardous ignitable waste. Once they make an IV out of it and send it up to the floor, it falls out of RCRA regulation because it's too diluted and it's being used for that purpose. However, it's a chemo drug, so we'd still want to manage it as hazardous under a best management practice. So just kind of have to watch when you do manipulate drugs, whether that changes their status. If we look at the characteristic of corrosivity, this is a very simple one, very straightforward, very acidic, pH of less than or equal to 2, very basic, pH of greater than or equal to 12.5. And normally you would find this in your compounding section. So we always recommend that you keep those down to the minimum in pharmacy and in lab for that matter, so that you don't have anything sitting around that looks like it's a waste. I'm old enough to remember the old days when folks had entire basements full of old drugs that were in corroding containers, so that you just don't want to have happen anymore. The toughest characteristic is that of toxicity, because we have 40 chemicals that each have their own specific leaching concentration. And what EPA is intending to do here, they want to keep an item, one of these items, out of a landfill if it doesn't pass what they call the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure test. In other words, it has to be at a very low concentration if it goes into a landfill so that it doesn't leach out into the drain water, which eventually goes back into the ecosystem. So, for example, if we look at some of these, we can understand arsenic. Barium sulfate in radiology, if you prepare it for someone, they don't drink it, has to be disposed of. Every item we've looked at will fail the T-clip on paper, so to speak. We actually use the molecular weight, try to figure out what the concentration is. I have had hospitals send their barium sulfate out, and it passed. So you're always free to send these preparations out for the test. If you aren't going to do that and you can't justify that they do pass, you should manage them as hazardous waste. In terms of, for example, the cadmium, chromium, and selenium, you'll often find these in multi-mineral preps. When you get it into pharmacy before you create a total parenteral nutrition, for example, many of these will fail. Once you dilute it and it goes up to the floor, it comes out of regulation most commonly. M-cresol we find as a preservative in human insulin. Mercury we still find in preservatives, especially thimerosal. So these will all, any mercury will cause it to fail. Silver we have in the burn cream. So these are much more subtle even than the P's and U's. You see Fluvax on here. That has a thimerosal preservative for adults. So these are a lot tougher to figure out and really take a lot of time if you're going to try to do them yourself. Excuse me. The last characteristic is reactivity. And I mentioned we're very fortunate here because nitroglycerin is the only drug that really fits that, and it has come out federally and slowly, slowly states are adopting that. So it does still have to be evaluated for ignitability. There's a few that are ignitable. Excuse me, 1 second. I wanted to just mention, since we have a national audience, that there are states that have stricter definitions of hazardous waste. We won't be able to go into them in detail, but these are the ones that kind of stand out as being those that really do need some additional concern, and whether they have additional waste codes or additional ways you have to manage waste, and that's always extremely important. There are a number of other states that have stricter management procedures in terms of satellite accumulation or storage accumulation and so forth. So, again, it's extremely important that you work with your state to understand those. I also wanted to point out again that we do have many, many chemotherapy agents that are not regulated by RCRA and in most states are not picked up as hazardous waste. And those of you in pharmacy will recognize these. They're pretty tough drugs for the most part. We really do want to treat them with respect and recommend that they be managed as hazardous waste as a best management practice. One of the things that's happened in the pharmacy and up in the nursing units over the last 20 years, many of us have worked with yellow containers that say chemotherapy waste on them, and it was a very logical thing to do that if you were working on a hood, in a hood, say, with Cytoxan and preparing it, one of the U-listed chemo drugs, and you're ready to throw out a partial vial and you have a container that says chemotherapy waste, it was a rational act to put it in there because we didn't realize that that really was going to a medical waste, a regulated medical waste hauler for incineration as infectious waste. And, I mean, the good news, it was being incinerated. The bad news, it was violating the federal law because there are different levels of incineration, and regulated medical waste incinerators are not permitted to take hazardous waste. So they are very appropriate for empty vials, syringes, and IVs, and any of your other gowns and so forth that might come in contact with chemo. But if the chemo is not empty and it's one of those listed drugs, it really must be placed into the hazardous waste container. And if it's one of the 100 or so drugs not regulated, it should be, just as the best management practice. So then we come to the question of what is empty. It just keeps going, doesn't it? If it's a P-listed drug, and now, of course, we have a lot of relief with epinephrine, but we still got arsenic trioxide and physostigmine and so forth to look at, they're really not empty unless that container has been triple rinsed with an appropriate solvent and the rinsate discarded as hazardous waste. That's not practical in healthcare. Again, this was designed for drums, for example, that were going to be reused, and they had dumped out whatever was in there, and now they want to reuse it. So basically, if it's on the P list, the wise thing to do is to manage that empty container as hazardous waste. For the U-listed chemicals and the characteristics, it's a lot more rational in that all contents have to be removed that can be removed through normal means, and no more than 3% by weight remains. So, for example, the empty Cytoxan vial, if you had drawn everything out that you possibly could, no more than 3% left, would be trace chemotherapy, could go in the yellow container, but if you have a cc or so in there that you could have pulled out, you really have to put it as hazardous waste. In pharmacy circles, the 3% got morphed into 3 mils in some circles, or it got changed to 1%. Those aren't really, those are kind of urban legends. So we really have to look at both of these definitions when we're making that decision. We do have a category at Pharm Ecology we call Pharm Hazardous, because what we're trying to do there as pharmacists, because our data is really analyzed by two other pharmacists, is try to pick up where RCRA leaves off. So all the drugs on the NIOSH Hazardous Drug Alert Appendix A we have labeled as this. Any drug that's on the report on carcinogens, for example, any other potent drugs that have very low LD50s, that's the lethal dose that kills half the laboratory animals, like colchicine, for example, endocrine disruptors, we're trying to come up under this and at least recommend that you manage those as hazardous waste. And we'll see what happens with the water people as they get involved. Let's take a moment and look at generator status. There's three federal levels, and some of the states are different. They've kind of combined some of these, or they've defined them a little differently, so you do need to check on that. But a large quantity generator generates more than 1,000 kilograms per month, that's 2,200 pounds of hazardous waste, or more than 1 kilogram or 2.2 pounds of P-listed waste. Now, the reason the epinephrine decision is so very important is that it was virtually impossible for any full-line hospital to stay out of large quantity status because of epinephrine. So with that coming off, hospitals will now have the opportunity, although not necessarily meet these criteria, but at least there's the opportunity to stay either small quantity or conditionally exempt small quantity. And you can see the two levels there, between 100 kilograms up to 1,000 for small, and then under 100 kilograms or equal to 100 kilograms per month for the conditionally exempt. Now, the caveat here is, even though there's this great opportunity, you do, as the generator, need to document how much P-listed waste you are generating per month to stay under those requirements. And any given month that you go over, you have to have everything in place as if you were a large quantity. So for those of you that already are a large quantity, you're probably just as well to stay there. You've already gotten through the hoops and set up a lot of the systems to do that. You don't have to document your P-listed waste, but if you are trying to stay under, you will need to segregate that so that you make sure that you are able to prove that every month you've stayed under that. And you can't average them over a year, for example. You shouldn't be using your manifest to prove that, because you might be accumulating 2 or 3 months before you manifest out. So you really have to look at it in the pharmacy and the nursing units per calendar month. So how do we handle this waste stream? Because for many of you, this might be a totally new waste stream that you're going to be setting up. You're really looking at one or two new waste streams in the pharmacy and certain patient care areas, oncology clinics, and so forth. You can combine your P's and U's and toxic B's all together, along with chemotherapy residues and chemo spills. There is a second possible waste stream, ignitables, but it's possible that you may be able to combine these into one waste stream based on both your state regulations and your waste vendor requirements. Because the whole idea, of course, is to simplify this as much as possible. If we look at some of the containment on the left, these are very typical examples of chemotherapy containers, and really we're encouraging people to consider this as trace chemotherapy now. And then this is one example of Kendall or Covidian Kendall's containers that have come on the market. They've now expanded this to try to meet some market needs. There's nothing sacred about the black. You can use any color you want, and the container just has to be packing group 2 and has to be compatible with hazardous waste and needs to be closed when not in use and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of opportunity here for different types of containment, but we just want you to encourage you to find something that is distinctive so that people understand that you have a whole totally new waste stream. Once you have your drug segregated and ready for disposal, you'll need to worry about labeling, waste profiling, manifest preparation, and something called land ban preparation. This is a land disposal restriction form. And these are very technical pieces of documentation. And unless you have someone in your organization that has a really good background in RCRA and DOT, we recommend that you work very closely with your hazardous waste broker, because they do this all day long, and they can help you and normally would take over this once you've given them the information that they need. And then either if they're a broker or if they actually are the federally permitted hazardous waste incineration facility, which is known as a treatment, storage, and disposal facility, that's where these drugs will finally go to be incinerated. Now, the next question comes up, what do we do with everything else? Because as we've gone through our data, we found about 5% of the drugs Our hazardous waste, another 10%, are what we call best management or farm e-hazardous. So about 85% of the drugs really aren't caught in either of those, and that includes antibiotics, antidepressants, antihypertensives, and very potent meds. So I think what we're seeing coming out of some of these water questions is looking at a best management practice of collecting these and then managing them through lower-level incineration, either regulated medical waste incinerator or a waste-to-energy municipal incinerator, but keeping them out of the wastewater or the water stream. There is always a concern about controlled substances. And, of course, DEA requires they be rendered non-recoverable. So in most states other than California and possibly Washington State, we're still recommending that they be drain disposed if they're small amounts. If they're larger amounts, you consider either a transfer between registrants to reverse distribution, or you consider using one of the waste haulers that has DEA registration, so you can do a transfer between registrants with them. In California, it's very tough, and basically DEA has kind of turned a blind eye and said, okay, we're not going to say much about this. You know, you can put it in like the white container I've shown here, which is used extensively in California for non-hazardous pharmaceuticals. But it's iffy. I mean, it's really not a good regulatory solution. So DEA hasn't really come up with any other opportunities, and I think that's still a discussion that's going to have to continue as we get more into this. If we just take a look so that we're all on the same page, I mentioned the municipal incinerators. Those are usually waste-to-energy plants. They usually cannot take regulated medical waste. So if you end up with sharps in there, that could be a real problem for them. The medical waste incinerators, of course, could take the sharps, which is good, and they very often are permitted to handle non-hazardous pharmaceutical waste. So both of those are opportunities. And then the highest level, the hazardous waste facility, the TSDF, they can take not only the RCRA waste, but, of course, anything below that, but that's a higher level of cost also. So you have to really work with your vendors, and I know there's some premier contracts available that you can work with to find out what the best solutions might be for you. What we commonly see when we go into a hospital, we still see a lot of, course, red bag, which might have some drugs in it, and that's normally going to an autoclave or a microwave and then being landfilled. We see the red sharps or needle boxes. We see a lot of drugs going in there because that's what nursing's been taught for 20 years. You know, put it in the red needle box, get it away from people, and it's going to be burned. Well, with all the Clean Air Act incinerators being taken down, these are generally being autoclaved and microwaved also and landfilled. So any drugs that goes into those red containers for the majority of facilities are going to end up in the landfill, which really just they call it postponed pollution. It's better than drain disposing, but it's still not optimum. The trace chemo, the yellow or the white containers, we see generally everything going in there that's chemo-related, including what we're calling bulk or non-empty, spill containment and so forth. That's usually going to regulated medical waste incineration, which is a step up from the autoclave, but it's still not at that highest level. Basically, if it's not chemo, we see it being drain disposed. So unused IVs, tablets, capsules, and so forth, a lot of those are going into the sewer, or they might even be going into the trash. So that's typically what we find when we go into a hospital and do our review. What we want to move to is adding the RCRA toxic and ignitable waste streams so that these are actually being segregated, going off to that high-level incineration, and then as a best management practice, although in some states like California it's the law, taking them out of the sewer and putting them into containment that will be sent then to a regulated medical waste incinerator. So that's the direction that things are moving in. I want to just mention satellite accumulation. That term is a RCRA term. It's very specific. It means collecting the waste at the area where it is generated. So that would be in the pharmacy, up on the nursing units. It should be readily available, if not in the patient room, which is a little awkward, certainly in a soiled utility room or in both the clean room and the general pharmacy. It should be labeled as hazardous waste, and with the appropriate waste stream noted, ignitable, toxic, or whatever. Federally, there's no time limit to fill that container, but there is a quantity limit. 55 gallons of U and characteristic waste, which you're never going to really want that much up there, or 1 quart of P waste. And again, with the epinephrine, this was a real issue. That issue is going to be much easier to manage now, assuming the states accept that new ruling. And then federally, they have to be moved within 3 days after those quantities are reached. In some states, such as Maryland, for example, it's much stricter. You have to move them immediately. So that's something else to take into consideration. So where you go with this is actually the storage accumulation, which is typically down in the basement, or if you're down south, it might be out near the loading dock in some type of secured area, where you would actually have the lab waste, for example, xylene, formaldehyde, that type of thing. If you're a large quantity generator, you have 90 days from the moment that enters to be picked up by the vendor. If you're a small quantity, you have 180 days. You do need to maintain an inspection log. There's a number of other requirements that we're not going to go into today, but that's where these would be held until they're actually picked up by the vendor. You can see the label there. That's a typical EPA DOT hazardous waste label that has very specific requirements that you want to work with your vendor on. Now I'd like to look at the management options, because I think that's where we're going now is, you know, we've understood a little bit about what needs to happen, so how do we make it happen? And some things that are universal is that we have found there is a need to label the items that need segregation in a manner that makes it easy for pharmacy and nursing personnel. The idea of trying to have a list and having people either memorize it or look it up really just doesn't work. You need your list to begin with, but then you need to find labeling options. One option we like to suggest is shelf stickers in the pharmacy. And I know most pharmacies are stickered to death. You've got a lot of different things you're trying to communicate. But that, you know, whether it's a black dot or a black label with a letter on it or whatever, that really is an extremely important step. The next step is really more difficult, and that's either applying it to your dispensing software, inserting a message into Pyxis or your medication administration record, and or stickers applied manually. And I'm going to show you quickly what some folks have done. These are based on the five models that were developed in the Hospitals for a Healthy Environment blueprint that some of you may have read. It's been out about a year and a half now. We found five different ways of doing this. There is an automated sorting device that's still in development that will probably be released next year. If you're bedside barcoded, you can use it. If you have enough flexibility in your software and you can label electronically, that's ideal because you only have to do it once. If you don't have that option, you can go to manual labeling. If that's difficult in terms of time and training, you can go to central collection, where all drugs are collected together and then sorted down in the storage area. That's obviously not a pretty picture, but it does get you where you need to be. And then you can also consider managing all drugs as hazardous waste, which is the simplest, but also the most expensive. If we look at the electronic labeling option, you do have to analyze your entire inventory. You have to still shelf sticker the pharmacy, but then you would enter a code of some type, and you obviously have to decide amongst you what that might be, whether it's HW1 for hazardous waste of one type or another, RCRA, BlackBin, whatever that predetermined code is, then that would appear on any drugs that need to go into the container. Nursing staff are trained on the waste segregation based on that code, and then you would have your satellite accumulation containers probably in the soiled utility room. There's nothing sacred about that, but it's a fairly convenient place. One hospital that is using a piece of that, and many of them are starting to do this, is North Memorial Healthcare up in Minnesota. And I want to say that Minnesota has been the most aggressive state in the country. I think they're up to almost 68% compliance now with their hospitals. They've been working with them for almost 4 years. So those folks have really been pioneers in making this happen. The next way, if you don't have that option, if you have a legacy system, for example, that isn't flexible, you would still analyze the inventory, do the shelf stickers, but then you would apply a manual sticker to each item, which, of course, is more labor-intensive. You are relying on people being trained in the pharmacy, and then you would train nursing staff to respond to that sticker. Again, North Memorial did use that as their primary program. I've put this website here. There is a link to Health Facilities Management, where we work together to describe it. But just to show you visually, this is the label they're using, special disposal required. You can see up in the left-hand corner, they have it on the shelf label in the pharmacy. They have chosen to do the best management practice of not only collecting the RCRA hazardous waste in the black container, but also collecting all other drugs in the white and blue container, going to a different incinerator. Now, the crash cart has this dual waste, which is labeled for both hazardous and biohazardous. The purpose of that was to collect the epinephrine vials. That may be able to go away. Don't know yet. And then you can see the trolley arrangement, which is nice because it's hands-free, up in the upper right-hand corner. The fourth model is centralizing your segregation, where all pharmaceutical waste is collected together in the nursing units in the pharmacy, so there's much less training. That waste is then removed to your storage area. The sorting is normally done by a hazardous waste vendor who's fully trained and hopefully correctly garbed and gowned and so forth. And you still would have to tell them which drugs to segregate, but they would actually do the segregation. Abbott Northwestern up in Minneapolis, another pioneer hospital, has chosen that method. You'll see they've got a little different configuration of their crash cart. They relabeled that particular Sharps container. And then you'll see the lucky lady here whose job it is to pull those out and compare them to the wall chart and properly segregate them into the blue hazardous waste dumps. So it works. It's a bit messy. But it's certainly a quick fix if you're under, say, intense regulatory pressure. And then the easiest, of course, is actually managing them all as hazardous. You may need to sort out ignitables. You still have to have an analysis so you can provide waste codes for manifesting and also to your regulated medical waste, or I'm sorry, your hazardous waste vendor. University of Wisconsin Health Systems has taken a hybrid approach to this. They're managing all tablets, capsules, and solids as hazardous, and then they're segregating out their IVs because of the weight. So they've used a little different type of label. I realize it's a little hard to read. It's basically a do not sewer label, and now they've added some more to that and put it on their shelf stickers where appropriate and so forth. So people have found different ways. I'm sure we'll see some other models coming out of this. What I'd like to do now is conclude by telling you quickly about some of the solutions that we offer through the Premier Purchasing Partners program to help you identify and manage the waste cost effectively and also in a compliant manner. We have basically five services, and they divide up into the data piece and the consulting piece. So the inventory analysis and the Pharmy Waste Wizard is our opportunity to help you analyze your inventory and also stay updated. The on-site risk assessment, the policies and procedures, and our implementation support and certification program is to work with you more intensely in actually assessing where you are initially and what you need to do to come into compliance. So if you worked with us, for example, on the inventory analysis, you simply send us the 12-month purchase history from your drug wholesaler on a spreadsheet. We would go through that. We have about 167,000 drugs in our inventory now in our database. We would compare that. Excuse me. One moment. We'd compare that to what you have and then provide you in 10 working days a complete list back. You would then have the opportunity to use our Pharmy Waste Wizard to access any of those drugs and look up new drugs coming into your inventory. I'm sorry. The second piece then would be we'd actually come on site, spend a day with you, learn a little bit about the pharmacy department, the nursing area, and your environmental services and safety folks, develop an action plan for you, and then work with you if you so choose for a 12 to 18 month period to help you get into compliance remotely and then come back and do a certification visit. This is not a trivial process. You really do have to plan on a 12 to 18 month rollout, so to speak, to do this correctly. One of the other areas that we can be of tremendous help is we have developed policy and procedure templates for all five of the models. And having written them, you know what agony it is to write policies and procedures. So hopefully those could be of use to you in getting your system up and running. One thing we've found is that even if you've simply started by having us do your inventory analysis, if you are visited by one of the regulatory agencies, they have responded really well to knowing that you're moving forward. And they will usually give you some leeway. We work very closely with them. We've worked with many of the states already to understand their programs better. So it does provide some insurance for you in terms of getting going. With the wizard, as I mentioned, this is site-specific. It's unlimited use and unlimited users. So we really want you, encourage you to use it as often as possible. We do have some state information, not down to the product level, but we will, as we learn, of course, about state's responses to the EPA now, include that in our state area in the wizard. So hopefully that can also provide some tremendous backup for you. And then our newest program is our certification program, because we feel if you've done all this work, you should have some documentation of that that you can use either from a public relations perspective or certainly to show any one of the regulatory agencies that might come in that you have gone through this process. And as we move through the states doing this, we will let the regulatory bodies know what the criteria are for this process, and they can then understand what you've gone through to earn this. So to summarize, we are finding that managing hazardous pharmaceutical waste continues to be an emerging and rapidly evolving management area. We've found several implementation models that have evolved now, and you know there may be more coming out. Successful implementation is very much an interdisciplinary team effort, and it has to include regular meetings, there has to be a champion. But the rewards include cost-effective compliance and certainly the evidence of a commitment to environmental excellence. So at this point, Andrea, why don't I turn it over to you? And I just want to mention we have some references that will be available when you download. And perhaps we can start taking some questions.
That'd be great. Mirella, if you could instruct our participants on how to register a question, please.
My pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a three-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw the registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure to lift your handset before entering your request, which again is 1-4. One moment, please.
And while we're waiting for our first question, I see that there's one that was in the one of the chat boxes that says, it's from Denise Shields, who struggles with which regulatory agency to follow when the regulations conflict, such as disposal of controlled substances. DEA tells us to prevent diversion, we must flush, and EPA says we must not flush. What is an organization supposed to do?
And that's an excellent question. Well, we have, as I maybe alluded to briefly, what we have advised people, if they're not in the state of California or Washington, that they check with their local publicly owned treatment works, tell them that they would like permission to dispose of controlled substances through the drain. Usually it's possible because you have such strict documentation through PCSIS and through witness disposal, you can give them an estimate of what kind of volume you're talking about. And we have found most of the treatment plants will enable you to do that. It's not ideal. If it's something like a fentanyl patch, we still ask that the best approach is to fold it up and put it, or cut it up and put it into a sharps container, preferably one that's going for disposal through incineration. If you're in one of those other states, as I said, most of the time they're putting it into the white and blue container, hopefully with the restricted entry, and DEA hasn't really been enforcing on that. But it's an awkward position. We don't have a good solution yet. We're hoping that the market will respond with some type of black box type thing that would actually render these non-recoverable. I think down the road, hopefully that will evolve over time.
Okay, great. Mirella, do we have any questions in the queue?
Yes, we do. Our first question comes from the line of Ellen McLaughlin with the Baptist Healthcare System. Please proceed.
Yes, you mentioned about a bedside automated system that's barcoded. Are you talking about the product made by Vestara, spelled V-E-S-T-A-R-A?
Yes, I'm talking about the Ecorex.
Yes,
the Ecorex. My understanding, that'll be released in 2008, early in 2008.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next question comes from the line of Raymond Renzi with North Broward Medical Center. Please proceed.
Yeah, I have a similar question about disposal down the sink, but this is specifically relating to non-narcotics. Say, for example, antibiotics residue. Do we flush it down the sink? Do we put it in a sharps box?
What we would recommend is that as a best management practice, it would go into not just a red sharps, but into one like the white and blue ones we showed that are specifically for non-hazardous pharmaceuticals, so that those would be sent off for incineration at a regulated medical waste facility or a waste-to-energy plant, so that they're not drain disposed. And it sounds like you're probably from Florida. Some of the Florida counties or cities, I believe, do have pretty strict drain disposal requirements because of, you know, you're so close to the sea level down there. So we'd really recommend that those get sequestered and sent off as non-hazardous pharmaceutical waste.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our next question comes from the line of Lisa White with the Texarkana Water Utilities. Please proceed.
Yes, ma'am. This discussion has been, the questions have been going on, do you flush or do you not flush? And as a representative of OPOTW, that's where we're going in our pretreatment meetings over the last several years. We're talking about pharmaceuticals tend to pass through our wastewater treatment plants and wind up in the environment. And, you know, this is the direction that I see the EPA going. I see the local POTWs going, saying, please don't put it in the drain, because this can, in a lot of cases, it cannot be treated in our wastewater treatment plants. It just goes right through them and goes into the creeks where we discharge our wastewater that's treated.
I think that's a good clarification and reinforcement that under best management practices, we want to start moving in that direction. Because if you're going to take the time to put in a pharmaceutical waste management program, why not take it up to the highest level initially rather than having to redo it again in a year or two? Thank you.
We've got another one from the chat box, which says, who is typically the champion of the pharmaceutical waste management system? Would it be, for example, environmental services?
That's a great question. It's very personality driven. It can be the environmental services manager. It can be the safety officer or manager. It can be the pharmacy director. It can be all three. Those are the primary three that we normally see taking the lead. And it really is almost equally divided in the hospitals we've worked with in terms of who gets on board first. We're now starting to see also facility managers and engineers have a chance to work with the ASHE people, American Society for Healthcare Engineering, and we see them starting to get involved. So any one of those can be the trigger point, and I think the main thing is that someone does champion it, or all three do, and move it forward.
Okay, great. I do want to just remind our audience, too, that you will be able to obtain the slides and the recorded MP3 of this session. It should be uploaded to Premier's website tomorrow. You'll be able to find it going to premierinc.com. And on that homepage, you'll see a link for education/newsletters under a heading of reduced costs. Also, we've got another question, too, if I may. What recommendation can we give to consumers that want environmentally friendly with meds they no longer take? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great question. And some of you might have seen the chatter that's going on if you're in the farm waste listserv. Somehow it migrated from using kitty litter to using used kitty litter, which is a pretty ugly thought. But the idea is that if it's a tablet or capsule, you dissolve it in a container, and then you add something really nasty so that people won't hopefully ingest it. You wrap it with duct tape. You put it in the garbage. So that's really the basic information. Hopefully, depending on where you live, there may be a take-back program going on periodically, or even in some areas consistently. There was a big conference in Maine a week or so ago. They have it every year. Dr. Steve Gressett runs that, and they're working very hard on a mailback program that they were given a grant for. In working with my old company, Capital Returns, a reverse distributor, I know in Wisconsin here, they're working on a pilot that would basically, once you pick your drug up at the pharmacy, you'd be given a number to call. If you can't use it, you call the number, you get a mailer. You send it to the reverse distributor, and then it gets documented and properly destroyed. The big question is who pays for it. I think it would be a wonderful product stewardship if then the manufacturer would provide the funding to allow that to happen. So we have a long way to go to find the optimum answer, but the short answer is don't put it down the drain. I know there's been some drugs that are still recommended to be drain disposed from a diversion perspective, but it's really a work in progress.
Do we have any other questions in the queue, Mirella?
Yes, we do. Our next question comes from the line of Mark Teratut with the city of Corvallis. Please proceed.
Yes, I'm one of those people that works doing pollution prevention with a water and wastewater provider here in one of those states that that is more strict. I'm in Oregon. And we've been trying to develop locally and statewide a program similar to what they've got going on that they're trying to work on in Maine, and that there is a program in Washington now that has been working. We've run into some friction from a number of places. One of them is the law enforcement because of the Controlled Substance Act. And basically we're told that we cannot take, you know, we can't have any way to take the stuff back because we can expect that some of the things that come back to us will be controlled substances, and they're illegal for anybody once they've been prescribed to go back. There's a lot of folks in our industry that want to help facilities like hospitals and pharmacies deal with some of these wastes, and getting some friction there from DEA and trying to get some exemptions, and I know that that's in place, and they're working on that in Washington as well as in Maine, and also somewhat from some pharmaceutical associations. And I would like to offer that if there are folks that are interested and helping kind of speed the process of finding ways to have some exemptions so that pharmaceuticals from places like hospice is a big one, because, you know, you get a 90-day supply of a big bag of stuff, and you get done with it, and you're told to flush it. And it does come into the wastewater plant, and we cannot treat all of those chemicals effectively. And we would like to be part of the solution, and we're finding that we're stymied. So I'd like to offer that we're looking for help to help you.
I want to thank you for that. Regarding this pilot that we're talking about in Wisconsin, we actually submitted rule changes to DEA about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, and they seemed amenable. Now, that was specifically to have it sent back to a reverse distributor because of the controls that are already in place, but I thought if we can get that through, it'll be a starting point. I know they're absolutely so concerned about diversion, but, of course, it's being diverted out of medicine cabinets. So totally agree with you that we all need to maybe apply some additional encouragement for some changes.
And if you can work with your associations, that your professional associations with medical, pharmacy, whatever, and let them know that this is something that's important to you, that might help coming from their members, because we kind of run into a wall sometimes.
You know, one of the difficulties you might be experiencing is that pharmacies are absolutely tremendously efficient at dispensing drugs. The problem they have is they don't have a good way to take drugs back. And I think there's been some resistance from my profession in that they're really not set up to receive drugs. And, again, that's why we're trying to push it over to reverse distribution, which is absolutely set up to take back drugs. So part of your resistance might be the concern about their liability in terms of bringing those drugs in and keeping them secured and so forth.
Absolutely.
So that might
absolutely
be a problem.
Absolutely. And there's models in place that don't actually require a pharmacist to be involved, and there's
mm-hmm.
still some friction, even if it's something that's not behind the glass.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's just my plea, is if, mm-hmm. you, if you're a member of one of those associations, let them know that you're a member, and you'd like to see them to work towards finding a solution for not just, I mean, it's a lot easier if you're internal and you're a hospital and you have things that haven't been dispensed yet, or if they're waste, we're talking a lot about hazardous waste. You know, it's just kind of very glossed over, the DEA, very short blurb about that. And one of my questions was, what do you guys do with that stuff? And it's a little different. You do have access to reverse distributors, things that haven't been dispensed yet. Once they leave a pharmacy, there's the only thing that can happen is a law enforcement officer can accept them, and that's it.
That's right.
And law enforcement is also kind of busy. They got things to do that they don't want to be involved in counting 6,000 little pills. So, anyway, I will leave with that comment.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Judine Bartley with Premier. Please proceed.
Yes, I just thought since there were a number of the comments about, you know, the organization of how this is approached in the hospital, it might be useful to be aware that because of participating in the process, I do know that the Joint Commission, as they're looking at their improvement process of all the standards, is really taking a hard look at the broad view of requiring a multidisciplinary group to look at the full waste stream to ensure that all the elements are dealt with appropriately by the different groups. So I just wanted to reinforce that comment that I think that that kind of understanding of the hazardous versus the medical waste is there, and the need to ensure that all the stakeholders are involved in trying to approach the best way to look at the whole waste stream.
Thank you so much. I think that's a really important point.
Our next question comes from the line of Don Holliday with the EMH Regional Medical Center. Please proceed.
Hi. Is there any movement to require manufacturers to list whether their product is a P list, U list, or D list?
Well, right now, the only thing we have are the material safety data sheets, and they're pretty woefully lacking. Some manufacturers do take the initiative to provide that information on the MSDS, but that's still hard to come by. The ideal situation would be something on the label. You know, it could be in the barcode. It could be embedded. It doesn't have to say hazardous waste on the label. Nobody would go for that. It's a little discouraging to know that about 8 to 10 years ago, when ASHP and the National Wholesale Druggist and a few other groups tried to encourage labeling of hazardous materials from an OSHA perspective, the two groups that opposed it were PhRMA, the association, the trade association, and the FDA. They didn't want anybody messing with the labels. So as you know, we finally now, FDA has required at least barcoding if it's going into the hospital, and that has had some interesting side effects. So unfortunately, other than the material safety data sheet, where they can also do the caveat of follow all state and local regulations, which doesn't help you much, you know, federal, state, and local regs, there is no requirement right now. And I think it would take tremendous political pressure to push that. But that may happen at some point.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from the line of from the line of Scott Wisniewski with the Summa Health System. Please proceed.
Yes, I got two questions. One, the first one is that many of us use a vendor to handle our expired drugs, and they will segregate out the hazardous waste. What responsibility do we still have with, in regards to using those types of vendors, especially if they improperly handle the waste? And then the second question is, I heard a rumor that an empty Coumadin unit dose package was considered hazardous waste and needed to be disposed of properly.
Good question. The first one, of course, I used to be involved very heavily with capital returns, so I'm very familiar with the reverse distribution process. If you send a drug back to reverse distribution, first of all, it should not be waste-like, and that's a concern because some folks do solicit waste, and they really shouldn't be. So it needs to look like it's a product. It needs to be in the original container, and it needs to look like it might be possible to at least be credited. Once it gets to the reverse distributor, if it cannot go back to the manufacturer or does not go back to the manufacturer for any reason, they have the responsibility of determining if it's a hazardous waste and of disposing of it properly. If it is disposed of improperly, you are still liable. You never lose your chain of custody, so to speak, in terms of liability. So that is a concern. You should make sure you're using a reverse distributor who understands the rules and uses, you can even ask them for information on who they're using as their hazardous waste vendor, for example, and how they do their processes. What's evolving in reverse distribution now that is of additional concern is the EPA and some of the states have come to realize that pharmaceuticals that are expired, even though they may have economic value, are never being recycled or reused. And a strict interpretation of RCRA would say, okay, then if you know you can't send it back, or if you don't get credit, you can't send it back. There's kind of different variations on the theme. So you should check with the region and with your state to see what their current position is on sending back drugs that become hazardous waste through a reverse distributor. I've heard in some situations, such as the Northeast in Minnesota, if you send it through, like say it was a nicotine patch, and you send it through and it continuously gets wasted, that you shouldn't be sending it through anymore because now you know it's a waste. So I think this is a moving target, but that's probably a little more than what you asked. You do have liability, though. On the second one, yes, I have heard of some states where under the empty container rule, they're actually considering a unit dose packet to be a hazardous waste. I've also heard of other states where they're saying, no, we're just not going to go that far. Unfortunately, there's a lot of gray areas, even within a state, It's very difficult to come to regulatory consensus. I know Minnesota's worked very hard on this. They may have 20 investigators out there, and they're all taking a little different view of it. So I think it's important, if you've heard this, to contact your state and find out in writing what their interpretation is going to be. And, you know, if you have an argument with it, I think you can certainly present it. Maybe the best way to do that is through the Pharmacy Society or Hospital Association.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from the line of John Loveless with Grady Health System. Please proceed.
Yeah, hi. Can you talk a little bit more about endocrine disruptors and pharmaceutical waste, and perhaps give several examples of pharmaceuticals that, when discarded, would be considered the endocrine disruptors that should be properly managed under BMP?
Sure, absolutely. The one that's gotten a lot of attention are the estrogens. You've probably seen some of the reports about, you know, fish downstream from a wastewater treatment plant being 85% feminized, finding immature ovarian tissue in male fish, that type of thing. So definitely the female and, of course, the male hormones, if they were in that greater pop of concentration. But it's primarily the estrogens. Another one that's very interesting are the antidepressants, because they've done studies on amphibians and found that they block thyroid function and prohibit metamorphosis. So you basically have now a bunch of tadpoles that'll never grow up, and of course that's not very healthy for the species. So those are kind of two of the very obvious ones. There was a big article, a two-page article last week in USA Today, front page, about endocrine disruptors, and of course there's a lot of them that aren't drugs. But certainly any of the sex hormones or related hormones would fit into that category. Ketoconazole has been shown to be an endocrine disruptor, and as I mentioned, definitely some of, depending on the species. And, you know, we're a little bit species-specific in that if it doesn't hurt us, you know, we don't worry about it as much. But we really have to remember that we're causing quite a bit of damage to aquatic organisms that have to live in this continuously refilling milieu of drugs. So I hope that helps. It's a huge subject, and it's evolving extremely rapidly. Oh, one other quick one. DES, those of us who've been around a while and dispensed diethylstilbestrol, that was a great example of causing cancer in the female children of the women who took DES during pregnancy to prevent miscarriage.
Would insulin be considered a insulin disruptor?
Not to my knowledge, but I don't pretend to know where all this is going. You can't assume that because it's a hormone, it's necessarily an endocrine disruptor. And I know people have asked about thyroid also. What I've done as a pharmacist is looked at the literature and said, okay, is there any prescription for prohibition against giving that during pregnancy? And that doesn't mean that's the end of the story, but obviously if we know it's teratogenic or any of these, we don't want to be giving it during pregnancy. We can pretty well figure there's something going on there. Obviously with insulin and thyroid and that, people are using that during, you know, pregnancy, and we're hoping that that's not a problem. So I think the jury is out. We'll probably find a lot more endocrine disruption as people get better at looking for it.
And we have one last question coming from the line of John Polka with Health First Cape Canaveral. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. This is John, and I got a question. You touched base on barium sulfate, and if you mixed up a cocktail and the patient didn't use it, that is definitely waste. As a D005, how about if in the subject of barium enemas? Has anybody got anything they've had to worry about in that subject?
If it's used, people have not fussed about it. So in other words, if it was inserted and the patient then excreted it, we haven't heard of anyone, you know, dealing with that. As one client actually was trying to be very, very diligent and sequester, but that's pretty ugly. So primarily we've heard that you just need to prove that if you are going to discard unused barium as a delisted waste, that you either send it out for analysis and it passes the TCLIP, or you manage it as hazardous waste.
Thank you. So from both ends, as long as it's used, we don't have to treat it as waste.
Well, and you know, that doesn't really meet the definition. I want to, for the RCRA purist out there, unused only applies to P and U. Technically speaking, the D list doesn't get excluded when it's used, but I have not heard of anyone enforcing at that
level.
Okay,
appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have no other questions at this time, so I'll turn the conference back to you, Ms. Marlowe.
Okay, thanks. We do have one more question in the chat box. Is it true that the preservative, for example, mercury, is what determines whether or not a drug is considered RCRA hazardous? We have a listener who was stating that the vendors that they're using has told them that their inventory analysis is based on specific NDCs, so some influence are hazardous and some aren't.
It's correct that some are and some aren't, and it's really not mercury. It's M-cresol in the insulin. It's a different toxicity characteristic chemical, and some of those are and some of those aren't. That's correct. If people, you know, if we work with them, we actually go by NDC number, and we will differentiate. If someone is doing this on their own and they don't want to go through that process, sometimes it's easier just to have people segregate all the insulin rather than proving which ones are and are not. But they're correct.
Okay. Mirella, do we have any other questions?
Yes, we do have a follow-up question coming from the line of John Loveless with the Grady Health System. Please proceed.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment more than a question. When you start talking about barium sulfate and enemas and things of that nature, if once it's used, it would be covered under the domestic sewage exemption.
Oh, well, that's good. That's a relief to all of us.
Well, yeah, it would make life a lot easier for everyone. But it makes it more tough when you try to explain that, well, you have to maintain it, because everybody knows that usually what happens with a patient, if they have something that they don't finish, they just go ahead and add it to the toilet and flush it along with everything else.
Yeah, that is. It makes it tough.
It's not logical.
I know. Many of these aren't.
And, Paula, we have no other questions at this point.
Okay, and I think it looks like we've pretty much answered them all. Shauna, do you have any closing words? I'd also like to just remind our participants that they'll be receiving some follow-up information from us, just an email. That will contain contact information should you have any further questions.
I just want to thank
everyone. Any closing remarks?
I just want to thank everyone for their time. I think the questions are very timely. I want to thank those people that work for regulatory organizations such as the wastewater treatment plants to give us some guidance there. I think it's a rapidly evolving area, and we all just have to stay in tune and hopefully start moving towards the optimum disposal situations. And thank you to Premier for making this possible.
Great. We really appreciate you giving us this presentation this afternoon. And we hope that everybody on the line will join us for future calls just like this. In the meantime, enjoy your afternoon, and we hope you'll join us again sometime. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines and have yourself a great afternoon.